Hello everyone, this is Joe Cristiano and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, your independent streaming internet radio station and libertarian voice, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday, April 1st, 2007. It is now 8:30 p.m. Central Time. Folks, this station is your antidote to popular talk radio, where you are expected to do more than just listen. You are expected to think. Although we broadcast from the United States, libertarian principles of individual freedom and responsibility are universal and apply to your area of residence, be it New York, Bangkok, Rio de Janeiro, Berlin, or Stalingrad. It's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our liberty, our freedom, and our property. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, please call in to 646-652-4620, and we'll take your comments on the air. If you'd like to speak to our guest, please do so. We'll have a guest this evening. At any other time, you may call in 903-551-2186 to leave a voice message. Of course, you may send us email at any time to comments@libertytalkradio.com. We will try to respond to your questions during our next broadcast. And here, Liberty Talk Radio, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Joe, George Phillies here.
Oh, George, thank you so much. Your timing was impeccable. I've just finished our introduction, and I was just about to introduce you. So if you'll hold on, I'll just introduce you to our audience. And are you speaking from a regular landline telephone?
I am speaking from a landline, but it's Vonage, not a landline.
Okay, very good. Try to speak as directly as you can into the telephone so we'll get as much vibrato out of your voice as possible, so you and I will be on the same wavelength. I mean, same from, the same tone, you know? Okay?
Much as possible.
Okay, very good. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this evening we have Mr. George Phillies. He's running for the Libertarian nomination for president in 2008. He has quite an extensive background, very impressive one, to say the least. He went to MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has his Bachelor of Science degree in physics and in life sciences, a master's in science in 1973, doctor of science degree in physics. He's joined the Harvard MIT Health Sciences and Technology program as a researcher. And I'm just going to go briefly over some of his accomplishments here. He moved to Worcester Polytech Institute, where he rose to the rank of professor of physics. Phillies has attained international recognition for his scientific studies of light, scattering, soaps, and polymer solutions. He served in the U.S. Army Reserves in the 338th Medical Detachment. He's participated very actively in the Libertarian Party in central and western Massachusetts. He ran for, governor, George, that you ran?
Congress.
You ran for Congress. I'm sorry.
I ran for Congress.
Okay, that's right, against the Democratic Party incumbent Jim McGovern and Republican Matt Amarillo. He's published a booklet that Let Freedom Ring and Libertarian Strategy Cassette, read nationally by thousands of libertarians and available free at cmic.org. Very good.
CMLC.org.
Oh, that's an L. I'm sorry. I got that down. CMLC.org / headerpublications.htm. Very good. George, thank you very much for being here this evening. I know Sunday evenings is a time where we're just winding down and probably don't want to do much whatsoever, just trying to wind down from the rest of the week. But we appreciate your being on our program this evening.
It's a delight to be here. I just got back from a trip to Tennessee where the Tennessee State Party had an extremely extensive and successful state convention. My throat is a bit dry. I apologize, but I've been on airplanes all day.
Oh, I know how that's like. If you can speak as closely as possible into the mouthpiece of the your phone, so we can grab as much of your voice as possible, that would be helpful. George, I have to ask you a question. I mean, if you being a libertarian, we probably know where you stand on most of the issues. I understand there are 13 people vying for the libertarian nomination for president. Am I about right? Do you know?
It's about that. Might be more, but it's about that.
More, okay. We had interviewed Christine Smith, Steve Cubby, and one person who's really, I guess, going to run most likely on the Reform Party, and that was Daniel Imparato from Florida. And that's about the past month. And I guess I can ask you questions about where you stand on the platform, but our listeners will probably know exactly where you stand because you're a libertarian. And that's what makes interviewing libertarians so difficult. Let me ask you this. What possessed you to run for president? This is not an easy thing to do. Can you explain that to us?
I was the volunteer coordinator in 2004 for Mike Badmerick, and before that for Aaron Russo. I was a campaign advisor for Don Gorman in 2000. We had some very nice people running for the presidential nomination back then, but it seemed to me that they'd somewhat missed the point. That is, they hadn't put effort into building up a strong campaign organization. Also, to be blunt, I can compare my record, which you just read off, with theirs, and I am at least as credible a candidate as any of the people you've mentioned. I have degrees from a major university. I have an international reputation. I'm a multimillionaire, though I try not to dwell on that too much. And I've talked a great deal about how we build strong campaigns.
Okay, how are you going to build your campaign, and how are you going to do it so that you have a chance of at least winning or getting some recognition for your efforts?
The major objective of a libertarian presidential campaign is to build the party. So we're doing large-scale volunteer recruitment. I have state coordinators. I have a chief of staff. We are using new electronic methods, AdWords, MySpace, Facebook. We're doing all these things to bring volunteers out of the woodwork. Then we give them training, we give them education, we get them together with other volunteers, and we build up groups that strengthen the party and get people active so they stay active after the 2008 campaign is over. What the voters think of this is up to the voters. I can't tell the voters what they're going to think of this. That's up to them. However, I'm going to do that. I am also making a major effort. I raise money. I spend the money on doing real politics. I'm not going to have a huge paid staff unless I raise colossal amounts of money. I'm not going to have fancy real estate. My money is going to outreach, to candidate support, to training the volunteers, finding them, get them together. Oh yes, ballot access. I've told my staff we may need to raise $250,000 for ballot access so I can be on the ballot in all 50 states.
The state of Oklahoma, in the last election, was, I believe, the only state that did not have a libertarian. Libertarian was not listed as a recognized political party. It was a political organization. So any libertarians had to run as independents. I think all the other states did. Our ballot access restrictions are quite high. I think we need 46,500 signatures, which means you need to gather somewhere around 60,000 by the time they throw out a bunch and whatever, you know, for duplication and whatever. And so it's very tiring every couple of years to go through ballot access. Is Oklahoma on your slate also for ballot access?
Oklahoma is there if we can raise the money.
Yeah.
So is West Virginia, which the National Party has given up on, apparently. So is D.C., if we can get the volunteers together. It's essentially a money issue. This is a problem we can solve the American way. We can bomb it with money until we do get on the ballot in all 50 states. Now, in fairness to the Oklahoma Party in 2004, they tried something different in order to help validate a lawsuit, and when the lawsuit didn't work, the alternatives were not there.
That's correct.
But I would hope to be on the ballot in all 50 states.
Okay, good.
In some, now, in some states, it's going to be as an independent. That's just the way the world is.
Right. Now, how long have you been actively campaigning, as you're doing now?
I launched my campaign close to a year ago. I declared in April 2006, roughly. We put up the web page. I send out announcements. We started doing fundraising. I've started doing visits all around the country to gather support. And most important, I've been building up a campaign staff. We're now up to about 50 people.
Okay.
I admit by the Romney standards, this is not so impressive, but for a libertarian, it's pretty good.
It certainly is. How do you measure your success thus far? Where are you on your timeline? Are you ahead of the game or what?
Well, I try to estimate where I am going to be realistic. And relative to my realistic estimate, I think I'm doing fairly well. I am disappointed by fundraising today. The problem with fundraising is, quite frankly, there have been several libertarian campaigns that spent their money very poorly. I can't do anything about that. And we have a couple of Republican campaigns that are poaching on Republican money. My message to libertarians is, when you give to a Republican, your donation counts twice. Counts once for the candidate, who may be a really nice guy. Counts second time to lend legitimacy to his party, a party of war on Iraq, war on drugs, warrantless wiretapping, kidnapping and torture of American citizens, all sorts of horrible things. And when you donate to a Republican, you're lending legitimacy to those acts. So I urge you to stop.
How do you see the Libertarian Party putting itself in a position where there is at least enough people behind a candidate to make a difference? If there are a dozen candidates, people running now who are all interested in running as president, the money gets diluted. For example, if I was going to give $100 to Libertarian Party, I'd wind up giving $8 to each campaign, which it would be more effective if I just gave the $100 to one candidate. Now, how do we get around that? It's a real conundrum.
The educated donor is the effective donor. It's just like buying clothing. Look at the label, look at the quality before you donate. There are really only two or three serious candidates for the Libertarian nomination at this point. I'm serious. Steve Cubby is serious. Christine Smith can say she's serious. How do you tell? Go to the Federal Election Commission, FEC.gov website. Look up who's actually there, who's raising money. There are lots of people raising money. There are lots of people who say they're candidates. There are very few people raising money. There are very few people doing spending. There are very few people with campaign material and web pages. And you can say, yeah, there are lots of names out there, but there are only very few of us who are really serious about running at this point.
Now, how are you going to get your name? You're not a nationally known figure. You're not a Ron Paul, for example. Although he doesn't, you know, he stands a very, very slim chance of getting the support of the Republican Party, obviously, because he's too libertarian. You don't have the, Barack Obama has a lot of press play and whatever. How are you going to overcome that? What are the specific techniques that you're using so that there are enough people out there looking at your campaign, thinking about you as a candidate, and making you making your whole campaign a credible issue?
We are going to use the methods that are really cheap. The internet. Governor Dean of Vermont demonstrated this with his 2004
That's
campaign.
Correct. Right.
Very effective. We're going to do student outreach, things like Facebook, MySpace, Tribe, Second Life. We are going to do the get volunteers to do effective things. And quite frankly, we are not going to waste money left, right, and center the way the major parties do. Then we've got another important advantage. There are a bunch of issues like the war on Iraq. I am against the war. So what do we have from the Republicans? We have a bunch of pro-war Republicans. Ron Paul isn't going to be the nominee. We have Senator Clinton, who's in favor of the war now that we're there. I say we should end the war, bring the troops home promptly. If we have a disagreement with Mr. Bin Laden, that's a spy agency problem, not a tank problem.
Right.
So we are going, and there are a whole series of other issues where we are the stand that the American people support and the other parties aren't. And eventually that makes a dent in things. Quite frankly, I view this campaign primarily as a bring out the volunteers, get people going, support candidates for lower office, build up the farm team. If I win, I am prepared to serve, but I'm not viewing that as my number one issue in terms of internal politics and planning.
Well, if you receive the nomination, then how does your strategy change, and what do you do differently after the nomination from what you did before the nomination?
At the present time, I am doing things that will build support within the libertarian movement. I'm speaking at libertarian conventions. I'm doing direct mail to libertarians. We have another 2,000 letters going out in the next month or so. I have long lists of libertarian activists I've built up from different places. After the nomination, I move to more of general election material. However, my evaluation of the current campaign is that I am well in ahead of my opponents. I am not going to lose track of the goal, win the nomination, but especially come start of 2008, when people start paying attention to the campaign, I am going over to general campaign mode. Talk radio, like your wonderful program. Blog ads, actually we've already started blog ads, including targeting libertarian and conservative groups. That's a cash-limited process, but we're getting a lot of impressions out there. We are going to start doing the things that get more attention of the general public, and we're going to start doing that way before the Libertarian National Convention. Afterwards, it's general public plus mobilized libertarians.
Do you have any sense at this point if you are attracting the attention, at least, of Republicans and Democrats, as well as the undecided independents?
I think it is too early for any libertarian candidate to be getting a great deal of attention other than from libertarians. Let's be realistic. Our recent presidential candidates have struggled to get a 0.5% of a vote. There aren't yet a lot of Democrats or Republicans who are looking at alternatives. However, come late this year, there are going to be a lot of progressive Democrats who realize they have a choice between Senator pro-war Clinton, we need a bigger army, and Barack, let's cave in to George Bush, as he said today, Obama. And on the other side, there are going to be bunches of conservatives who are going to look at three anti-gun rights, all sorts of other terrible things, not at all conservative Republicans, and they're going to be looking for choices too.
Okay. Now, Who would you prefer? Is there any one person that you would prefer to run against, both as a Republican or and as a Democrat?
I think I would rather run against Senator Clinton than Barack Obama or Senator Edwards, simply because Senator Clinton is much more to the left on foreign, or right rather, on foreign policy issues.
Okay.
I am perfectly happy to run against Giuliani or Romney or McCain, but I think Giuliani is the best target to run against as a Republican, because he's against Second Amendment rights. He gets tagged as the guy who is a big spender from a big spending state. And of course, realistically speaking, the Republican you run against is one man, no matter who they nominate. It's the George Bush Republican Party. And I will certainly be running, no matter who they nominate, against the George Bush Republican Party, because they've given us a target the size of a barn. We might as well shoot at it.
Right, yeah. What, personally, why did you decide to run for president?
Honestly?
Yes, please.
Someone asked me. And why did they ask me? They looked at who they thought was going to be running for president as a libertarian, and they didn't like them. Now, as it turns out, Michael Badnarik is not running for president again, so that issue has gone away. And now I just ask, I mean, yeah, I'm not the world's perfect candidate. I'm not a six-term senator. I'm not a billionaire who can fund a huge campaign. However, we're libertarians. We only get the choice of the candidates we actually have.
Right.
What can I say? I have solid college degrees. I'm permanently employed. I don't have a criminal record. Open my closets, no skeletons fall out. I've never driven a company bankrupt. I've never used alcohol or drugs to access. You name it, I am the guy who is credible in a wide variety of different ways. Plus, I have the record of developing a strong campaign, not just being a nice guy who looks good.
You know, I could be a real wise guy now. I said, well, now that you've said that, you've just disqualified yourself for public office. Only joking, of course. Where do you stand on... let me ask you a few questions on a few issues that I have very strong opinions on, and yet I get a diversity of answers. Where do you stand on term limits for everyone? Whether it be Congress, Senate, or the House, President, and whatever.
Regardless of theoretical issues, the people should be able to choose whoever they want, and so on. I think the consequence of having the same person in position indefinitely turn out to be bad.
Right.
That's an empirical observation.
Right, right.
And by the way, that also applies to LP state leaderships. You've got some people who are really great, but if they're there permanently as chair for life or chair forever, eventually things turn sour.
Right. What about our voting methodology we have now, where it's a yes or no vote for one person on the ballot versus something like an approval voting system, and there's several others that allow that level the playing field? Do you have any particular favorites in mind, and are you espousing any of those, you know, should you get into office and have the opportunity to make changes?
First of all, I don't think there are any, even if I win the election, which would certainly shock vast numbers of Democrats and Republicans, I think changing that would be very difficult, and quite frankly, I would want to put my political capital on much more important issues. Dealing with the national debt, dealing with the war, dealing with the need to bring the federal budget under control. Well, I can go down the list.
Okay.
Also, last point, I'm on a university faculty that has tried several of these schemes. In practice, they don't work the way you would think from the theorists who describe them, and you will probably be somewhat disappointed if you change voting schemes. Approval voting, what happens? almost everyone votes a bullet ballot. They only approve of one candidate. I've seen it in action.
Okay. But you do have an opportunity to vote no, so at least you take some of the apathy out of the voting.
You certainly could encourage people to vote no and give no as a choice, and if no wins, you try again with new candidates. The problem with that is that if you have a fixed term for the previous person, you've got some real complications you have to fix. So my inclination is to say, yeah, you can change voting schemes, but that really is second-order stuff that isn't going to get you where you want to be, the libertarian future of peace, liberty, and prosperity.
Okay. How would you resolve the immigration issue?
Immigration is a wonderful thing. Because of immigration, we have vast numbers of people with all sorts of different perspectives on life and all sorts of other contributions. Having said that, I do think the American people are entitled to, if they pass a law, it should actually be enforced. You may urge them to change the law, and there are laws I will certainly urge the American people to change, but if you're going to have a government that earns the respect and trust of the American people, it's actually got to carry out the laws it has until they're changed. I suppose you can get some truly outrageous law where you wouldn't say that, but we're not talking about that now.
Well, the quota of for the number of people allowed to come in from Mexico is low relative to the number that we need. Is it really the law, or is it just the quota system that needs to be changed? And should we not call these people who come here just to work over-quota trespassees rather than illegal aliens?
The notion that we absolutely have to have Mexicans to do bottom end of the totem pole work, or actually, these days, it's Guatemalans and people from further south, more
correct,
than Mexicans.
Right.
I believe that's mistaken. What is happening is, because we have this, the price of labor has been depressed, and this is George Bush doing favor for his corporate buddies, and therefore Americans don't go into it. The area where we actually do get that sort of benefit from immigrants, where we get foreigners who will go into jobs that Americans will not, is actually in the sciences and engineering. And people don't seem to quite recognize this, but in fact, when you talk about, farm labor or construction labor or whatever, most of the people doing the work are in fact Americans.
Okay. I did not know that. I thought most of the people who are doing the the backbreaking work were people coming over from the south.
Well, of course, I'm fairly far northeast, but I just had my home rebuilt. One fine day, there were 15 cars in front of the house because the painter believes in let's do it all in one day. Absolutely none of them were Hispanic. I spoke to all of them. They were all wonderful, hardworking Americans or recent immigrants.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that would not be the case in Tulsa. In fact, I just had we've been in a 15-year drought in this area, on and off, and so the clay subsoil is extremely dry. Many foundations are cracking, and mine cracked, and I had to have supports put in and whatever, and there was the supervisor was English speaking, but everyone else was Spanish speaking. You know, I think the further south you go, the more you'll find that there's a large contingency of Spanish speaking or Latino, and the terminology escapes me because I'm not sure which is which anymore. But people from down south, beyond the border, coming here and doing that type of work. I'll be honest, I'm in business for myself, and I can't get people to work. It's very, very difficult. Many companies I do business with, they just cannot get people to work. And if they do, they just work there for a couple of weeks because it's kind of hard work, and they leave. And the turnover is just absolutely phenomenal.
Well, I certainly, on my state party, we have a fellow who hires people to do things like file clerk. Sort of bottom level, if you're a high school graduate and can read English, you can do it. And it's indoor work, no heavy lifting, and he's got to go way above minimum wage to get anyone.
That's correct.
Because
right.
There are places where the minimum wage really does make a difference in how much people earn, but there are large areas where for lots and lots of jobs, even if you're a supermarket bagger in this area, you don't start at minimum wage, or so the baggers tell me.
Right. In my company, no matter what you do, you will never start at 5:15. I couldn't hire anyone at 5:15 if I tried. I mean, someone would have to be so desperate you wouldn't want to hire that person. I mean, that means they really have problems. What about the minimum wage issue? Should that be a function of the federal government, or should that be a function of the free market system?
The minimum wage at this point, at least where I am, is irrelevant because it's so low. You can't hire people to do almost anything at that level.
Correct.
The minimum wage mostly protects or discourages teenagers from getting starting jobs where they can show they show up for work regularly for weeks or months at a time. But in terms of what it does, saying, oh, we should increase the minimum wage, we'll give people more money. Well, all those people who worked hard to get moved up from the minimum wage to $5.56, $6.57 an hour, suddenly these people have been slammed back down to the minimum wage and all their hard work is for naught. That's not very nice to them, and it does tend to inflate. Fortunately, there are a lot of industries, unlike 30 years ago, that are much more efficient than they used to be. So, for example, fast food chains, they may pay people minimum wage, but they're totally efficient, and if you crank up the minimum wage, that number just goes over into the cost of hamburgers because they don't have people they can get rid of.
Right. All right. Let's change venues for a minute. You know, the ubiquitous healthcare issue, and I don't even like even the use of the term healthcare. I don't think it aptly describes a problem that we have or really the issue, but let me use it because that's what everyone calls it. We have a healthcare crisis in America, or so they tell us we do. How do you tackle that?
What do I propose to do first? Number one, you spend money on legitimate healthcare. Medical drugs, physicians, hospital stays, you name it, legitimate medical care, the tax consequences are the same no matter whether you pay the money, your insurance pays the money, whoever pays the money, it's not taxable income. So all health care gets treated the same.
Okay, fair. Okay.
Number two, I'm going to cut the cost of your health insurance by 30% overnight, assuming Congress cooperates. How do I do that? It's called cost transfers, and we'll ban them. A few years ago, Congress had the brilliant idea that any hospital that covers Medicare for the elderly should be required, if someone shows up at your emergency room, you have to treat them. Well, that's very interesting, but Congress didn't appropriate any money to pay for it. They just said, you've got to do it, you've got to find the money yourself. Well, I'll tell you where they found the money. They're called cost transfers, and they transfer the cost into your medical insurance. So when you go into the hospital and are hospitalized, your insurance is paying for the people without medical insurance. And
right.
By the way, these are the people who go through the ER, which is the least cost-effective method of delivering medicine known to man. If Congress wants to require ER treatment availability, Congress should have the fortitude, I know that's asking a lot of congressmen, to require that the federal government pay for what they're requiring people to do. That's simply a matter of fairness.
Right.
And that would have an enormous effect on the cost of your health insurance. Actually, those two changes are so radical that you probably need to wait a few years until things settle down to see what to do next.
I see. Right. From your perspective, which is the very, very top issue that needs to be addressed first?
End the war in Iraq. End the war on Iraq. Bring the troops home. Notice that the Cold War has been over for a while, and our armed forces built up to defend against the Soviet Union no longer have an opponent. Now, do we have a problem with Mr. Bin Laden? Yes, that's why we have a spy agency. That's the number one issue.
Okay. What about, we say the war in Iraq, we're also occupying Afghanistan.
That's correct. I count that as part of the same issue.
Okay.
We installed an Afghani government, and at some point, guys, the mayor of Kabul has to sink or swim or make peace or not on his own, because we can't simply leave troops there to keep them installed.
Mm-hmm.
As it stands, yeah, he's a foreign leader. He's got 200 American mercenary bodyguards, without which he'd be lucky to live out the day.
All right. Right now, we have troops, I believe, in about 130 nations. We have bases in about half of those. What do we do with all of those?
We bring the bulk of the troops and the bulk of the ships home. You should realize that nation count, a lot of those nations are the four Marines who are the embassy guard in Tonga, for example. And so there are a lot of countries where, gee, that's not really a base or threat. It's just how we work.
Right. We only have bases. They claim 150. I'm sorry. I think in 50, but I think it's probably closer to 60 because there are some stealth bases that we have out there. So we'll call it between 50 and 60.
Okay, we bring everyone home from Europe. The Cold War is completely over. We do active, aggressive outreach to Russia as a country that we would like to be friendly with, because they now have a democratic government. They now have some issues left over from their former government, and we would like to be their good friends. And it might be that we and they would agree on a mutual defense agreement, because that's much better than the alternative. But we bring the troops home from there. We bring the troops home from Latin America and Africa and South Asia and most of the Pacific. We don't need to garrison Japan to avoid the danger of the Japanese rising in favor of the emperor. They aren't going to do that. We need to think carefully about Korea, and I wouldn't be too precipitous there, because the North Korean-led leader really is a bit of a loon, and you have to think about that so you don't frighten him into doing something to kill millions of people. So we bring the people home, and we demobilize. In particular, we're not planning on invading anyone. We don't need a navy with huge numbers of amphibious craft, because they're only fit for invading enemy countries, and there aren't any to invade.
Right. Well, we just launched recently the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan, which is a mammoth vessel, and I often wondered why we were still constructing offensive naval craft when there is really no one to fight at all, especially on the high seas or even near the high seas.
We have a huge Atlantic fleet that makes no sense. The Atlantic is only bordered by countries with no interest in attacking us.
Mediterranean. Should we have... I'm sorry.
You probably want to maintain at least four aircraft carriers, because there's some extremely complicated skill sets involved in keeping carriers running. And if you lose them, it's a whole lot more expensive to recover than to keep a few carriers around.
Okay.
Three or four. The rest go into storage.
The $3 billion or so we give to Israel every year in foreign aid, what's your opinion of that?
We give the Israelis $3 billion, the Egyptians $2 billion. We're bribing them not to go to war with each other. The truth of the matter is, Israel is a large nuclear power. The Egyptians have figured this out. They're not going to attack Israel. And that's $5 billion that we can save out of the federal budget right there.
Okay. The Palestinian issue and Israeli issue.
This is one of these things that cannot be fixed by anyone, and we just have to realize the basic problem is you have several groups of people, all of whom claim the same land, and none of them are going to compromise. And so our position should be, we wish you would grow up someday and find some sensible solutions, but we don't have any way to help you.
Should we just bow out and just let sort of nature take its course and, you know, let the best man win and end it there?
We should bow out. We should vigorously stand up for, you know, we fought World War II and the Cold War in part over genocide issues, and massacring each other is socially unacceptable, and we can enforce that quite vigorously. But we should just bow out of the area. If we have private citizens who want to try doing diplomatic things, President Carter has done this occasionally, God bless him, we should be enthusiastic about supporting that. But the truth of the matter is there's some problems you just cannot fix.
No, I agree. Any troops in the Middle East to protect the oil lanes, yes or no?
Unnecessary. The main issues in the Middle... Yeah, we have the war going on in the Middle East. We have the local citizenry shooting at our army in their country. If the situation was reversed, our people, let's be honest, would be doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
The best solution we can find for Iraq is to bring our people out of there, make clear to the Iraqis that we're willing to offer them things to help them, things that do not necessarily cost the taxpayers $100 billion a year, because we're just throwing money away on a war that cannot be won and that simply makes the situation worse, not to mention it's killed 2/3 of a million Iraqis.
Right. Maybe you can help me out. I have a problem understanding. I mean, I understand our monetary system, and I think that's the problem because most people believe that money is actually money. But when you study money and banking and you study our monetary system, you realize we got a real problem. At least I see it that way. Should we maintain the same fiat currency as we always have, backed by the good faith and credit of the United States? Or should we have a currency backed by something tangible? And throw in the Federal Reserve if you want to talk about the Federal Reserve system.
Okay. Money is backed by the fact that people are willing to take it in payment. Period. I know there were libertarians many years ago who kicked up all sorts of confusion on this. Frankly, the Federal Reserve system, except for one specific technical issue, is a third-order issue of not great importance to the American people. The third-order issue is, should the Federal Reserve Board actively try to manipulate the interest rate and the rate at which the money supply grows, or should the money supply be allowed to grow at a uniform rate that matches more people, bigger economy? And
right.
I'm inclined to say that we should probably try the latter for a reasonable period of time. We've tried the former, and it does some good things and some bad things. I'd rather talk about the important issues facing our country.
Okay.
Civil liberties, they're falling apart with illegal warrantless wiretaps on down the line. I will ask Congress for a corps of special prosecutors so that all of the people who have been doing all of these illegal things for George Bush are given the fair trials they denied Jose Padilla. Energy and the environment. I will propose a federal government buy electricity from renewable sources. Fixed rate, long-term contracts. Federal government doesn't get involved in boondoggles building coal liquefaction plants or sun oil or God knows what else. It buys the electricity at a fair rate with at most a modest premium over current rates. Don't worry, in a few years, those contracts are going to be great bargains. And we start doing that, and that will incidentally also be about as much as we can do short-term in dealing with environmental issues. Education. I propose that we attach to every child a $5,000 tax credit. Whoever puts money into the little kid's education can take those dollars off their tax bill as a credit, not as a deduction. And that means if you're a public schooler, you can enrich what your children have. If you're in private school, it's tuition. If you're a homeschooler, it's all sorts of things. And if you're like me and don't have children, you can rescue some poor child from Washington, D.C. public schools and the clutches of the school district and Congress rooms. And I think that would be very positive. And finally, end the worst tax of all, the grandchild tax. The grandchild tax is the national debt. We spend the money, we send the bills to our grandkids. That's like we spend money, we've got kids in college, we send them the credit card bills instead of vice versa. That's
right.
A terrible thing. And over 30 years, we can get rid of the national debt with real discipline.
Yeah.
How do I get discipline? Well, I'm going to be the first president of the United States with a computer in the Oval Office, and I'm not going to have a veto pen. I'm going to have a veto high-speed laser printer.
I like that.
And perhaps at some point, I will copy the lesson I gave my students in freshman physics. I said, I'm going to show you a tax cut, and I had the TA pile up dollar bills on a grill. This was about 40 of them. It's my money. And we soaked them in ignitable liquid and stepped back, and the students were wondering, what's he going to do? This is obviously a joke. And then I torched 40 bucks. This is a class cut. And I'm going to be prepared to do the same thing to the American people with my own money. This is what your government wasted in the last microsecond. I go out to a second, but I think I'm too poor to afford it.
Right. Well, right now we're in, our debt is over $9 trillion. And our unfunded liabilities, it gets to something like $59 trillion, which is a unfathomable figure, you know, by any stretch.
Absolutely. I propose paying off the funded liabilities. The unfunded liability number, it could be off by a zero. Why? Well, sooner or later, modern medicine is going to do something about extending the lifespan of healthy people like us. And instead of expecting to live 70 or 80, 90 years, genetic medicine is going to let us live 130 or 150, and when that, in good health, good, happy, not too old health, and when that happens, the whole Social Security system goes down the drain. It's just unsustainable, even more than it is now.
And that's interesting. I guess we don't talk on that issue. We don't look at it that because we think that's too futuristic, but it's true. People are living much longer than they were before. And Social Security was designed to provide benefits to people who died 2 years before they ever collected, basically.
That's true.
Right.
And that is going to collapse one way or the other. Now, realistically speaking, collapse is overstated. What happens is the income will cover 60 or 70% of benefits. And people will, as a practical matter, whether we libertarians like it or not, put in means testing, and the system will sort of stagger along as a second-rate cheat. But let me make a point here, and this is a point for all Americans. I'm a college professor. My pension takes as much money as Social Security does. When I retire, my pension will give back to me 5 or 10 times as much money as Social Security does. That's an enormous difference. It's a difference that every American who just relies on Social Security is missing, because Social Security money isn't really invested, not in any meaningful way.
Correct. Well, the whole issue of our monetary system sort of bothers me, because I see it as a time bomb that, if it ever goes off, will be worse than any war that we've ever been at. Because someday someone may wake up and find out that their dollar bill is not worth a dollar bill, and it was never represented what they thought it represented. And that creates actual social chaos. For example, if Social Security was going down the drain, it needed funding. We all know the government will just start printing money like crazy, putting even more money in the money supply. That, in fact, inflates the amount of money that, you know, raises the cost of everything. I guess this is what I'm getting at with our currency system right now. We just create money when we need it, and then we just inflate the money supply, and basically it becomes a tax on the individual because my dollar is now only worth 98 cents instead of a dollar, as it was a few weeks ago.
You have put your finger on why we have the Federal Reserve, the independent central bank. When the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, they only knew two sorts of ways to solve the problem. One was to print the money on silver or gold or chips of wood.
Right.
And the other was to have the Congress print money whenever they wanted it. And they knew if you print money whenever you want it, things go nuts. We moved to separation of powers. And separation of powers means the people who control the money supply don't run for re-election, can't be really effectively threatened by Congress, and keep the money supply under much tighter control. And as a practical matter, I know some libertarian theorists don't like this, independent central banks have actually worked pretty well. As Churchill said of democracy, it may be the worst system you can imagine, but all of the others are worse.
Okay.
There is, however, a much more serious problem, and that's the trade deficit. And that may, you are right, may blow up.
Well, in the trade deficit, that money comes back to the United States as a form of investment. Now, they could buy treasury bills and whatever, so they sort of own us in a way, or they can own the corporations. They can take that money and buy stock in General Electric. So eventually, General Electric is owned mostly by foreign money. But all that has to come to an end because there's only so much they can buy. If the debt continues to increase, trade deficit continues to increase and they keep on coming in, investing the money, eventually they will own everything and we'll just be renting this place. Am I right or am I wrong?
At the present time, all that money abroad basically is in treasury bills, a little is in corporate paper, a little is in stocks. So if it comes back, that means treasury bills get dumped and interest rates go up, right, and these people start buying things. But there's something called supply and demand. And if you show up with, actually it's a small part of the net worth of the United States, it's like $4 trillion you can show up and America's worth 40 or 50, that means the stock market will go great guns. American companies that are short of investment capital will be able to sell IPOs, as they did in the dot-com craze, to foreigners, most of whom don't have a clue what they're buying, and it will actually be very nice for America. However, corresponding to that, the value of the dollar will fall, and the cost of imports will go sky high. That means your gas is going to be expensive, and suddenly all of the companies that couldn't compete on making consumer goods in America now can and can hire all those Americans who don't have good jobs at the moment.
Okay. Well, where do you see the danger in the current trade deficit? Where do you think it's going, and what is the danger there?
Okay, the trade deficit keeps going up. The danger is at some point foreigners are going to want to trade their dollars for other currencies or for capital goods and the value of the dollar crashes. The danger is the transience, because when all this is happening for a few years, things are chaotic. However, in the long run, a weak dollar is much better for most Americans than a strong dollar.
Right.
Weak dollar means foreign currency is expensive. Foreigners come here and can buy American-made goods and be happy with the good bargains they get. And that will be a great benefit in the long run.
Right. It would just be more expensive for us to buy something overseas.
That's correct. And for things that can only be bought overseas, like oil or, God knows, caviar or wine, it's going to get more expensive. for things that could equally be well be made here, consumer electronics, it's going to be a great boon to the American worker when everything settles down.
Okay. All right, George, we're winding up. Boy, we've been broadcasting now with you for about 55 minutes. We have a couple of minutes. Would you like to make a few closing comments and possibly tell our viewers, our listeners, how they can reach you, about your campaign, how they can participate? Now, I'll give you 3 minutes and it's all yours. Go for it.
Okay. I've talked about a few issues. Phillies2008.com. My name is just like the baseball team. It's just like the cigar. Phillies2008, all dot one word, .com, and you can read all my issues. Point one, to Americans across the country. We can talk about alternatives for the future. We can talk about the shining city on the sunlit hill, the future without fear, the golden promises of the Declaration of the Independence. There is one political party that has the key to that shining city, the Libertarian Party. Why? It's something that a former American president had almost right. Ask not what your government can do for you, because if you do, very soon you'll be lamenting what government is doing to you.
Right.
Ask instead what you willingly, freely, voluntarily choose to do. That's message number one, the Libertarian Party and Phillies2008.com. Message number two to my fellow libertarians. Whenever you donate or support a candidate, your donation and support count twice. Once for the candidate, once for the party. Whenever you support a Libertarian Party candidate, whoever they are, you're strengthening our party for the future. Whenever you support a Republican or a Democrat, no matter how nice people they are, you're strengthening the party that gave us the war on Iraq, warrantless wiretaps, gross federal corruption, kidnapping and torture of American citizens, all sorts of terrible things. And you should, if you are a good libertarian, you should not ever be supporting a Republican or a Democrat because you're working against your own interests. I'm George Phillies. I'm here to give us a strong campaign based on strong campaign principles. Talk about issues people care about. Organize volunteers. Spend our money wisely. Be the candidate you can be proud of 100% of the time as the credible candidate, the serious man for serious times. I hope you like that message. Joe, it's been great to be with you.
George, thank you so much. It was a privilege and an honor to have you on our radio program. I wish you all the luck in the world. And if there's anything that this station can do for your campaign, all you need to do is ask.
I look forward to speaking with you regularly in the future. Please also reach out to our other candidates. The libertarian message does need support, and I'm very grateful to you.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Thank you so much, and good night to you.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was George Phillies, who is running as a nomination for the Libertarian Party for president. And he certainly is an impressive person. Wouldn't it give us a sense of pride and confidence if a gentleman like Mr. Phillies was our president? Just think about that. Think about what we have had in the past. And then think about what Mr. Phillies said and talked about. And how he talked about it. And how articulate he was. How purposeful he was. How sincere he was. The change would be momentous in and of itself. I hope he has a campaign that's successful, and that we see him once again. Okay, well, now it's time. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends. And let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Again, comments@libertytalkradio.com. Or you can phone in your questions to area code 903. That's 903-551-2186. 903-551-2186. Next Thursday morning at 6:30 is our next live broadcast. We will continue our talk about the gold standard in banking and give a little insight as to where all that started and maybe where it's going. We hope you can join us at that time. And if you do join us during our live broadcast, you need to call in. It's 646-652-4620. Remember, folks, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you are striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Until next time, stay well, stay tuned.